This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Hockenberry, and for Ray Suarez, it is great to be here, back in the live radio seat at NPR. I mean, the last time I hosted Talk of the Nation, it was back in 1992, and NPR was still in its non-wheelchair accessible building on M Street in Washington, D.C. Inaccessible? There's that issue of disability popping itself into the foreground, which is why I am so pleased to be here to help NPR launch a week of special programming on public radio all across the spectrum called Beyond Affliction, the Disability History Project. All week long, there's going to be an exploration of various medical, policy, and cultural issues surrounding disability in America and the world. What? A week-long series on disability? I mean, what a way to turn off listeners. I mean, where's the 800 number? Can't I just send a check to the telethon? What do I need to know about disability besides how to avoid it? Yeah. But that's exactly what we want to address all week long here. It is the beginning of the third generation of what I like to call the age of disability survival. In contrast to most of human history, people with severe physical disabilities and people with mental and perceptual disabilities are now able to survive and really integrate their lives into a world economy that is relying less and less on physical capability, on being located in a specific place. The consequence of all this is disabled people surviving, thriving, demanding, contributing, in short, carving out all the roles of citizenship. And it's not as though disability is a really remote subject these days. Just last Friday, Christopher Reeve was interviewed once again by Barbara Walters as part of the publication of his new memoir, which relates his disability experience. Reeve's story of dealing with quadriplegia presents many of the very traditional storylines we've come to know disability through. Hopelessness becomes hope, becomes struggle, becomes redemption. This week, we want to show, we hope to show, that most disabled people are living unheroic but very interesting, rich, full lives. That disability is a cultural experience that enriches American life with its stories in much the same way other groups in America have emerged to become part of our grand human tapestry. So that's our mission for the next hour or two on Talk of the Nation, and for the entire week here at National Public Radio. My guests for this hour are Paul Longmore, the director of the Institute on Disabilities at San Francisco State University. He's a professor of history at San Francisco State. He joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco, California. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, John. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you here. Also, Judy Heumann, Assistant Secretary for Special Education and Rehabilitation Services. She's with us in Washington, Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Nice to see you, John.
Pretty accessible down there, huh, Judy?
It's great.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I've only been to that new building once. And also joining us, John Callahan, cartoonist, general all-around famous guy, and wry, some would say, sick wit. His strip is called No Witnesses, and he's also the author of Will the Real John Callahan Please Stand Up? He's on the phone from Portland, Oregon. Thanks for joining us, John.
Good morning, John. Thank you.
It's great to finally meet you, you know?
Thank you very much.
I feel our lives have been connected for a long time.
I enjoyed your book.
Well, thank you very much. And I've enjoyed all of your cartoons, and we might make reference to some of those over the course of the hour. Let me begin, though, with Paul Longmore. Paul, how is disability a cultural experience, and what does that really mean?
Well, one thing it means is that most of the experience of disability is not inherent or inevitable in a variety of medical or physical conditions. Most of what people with disabilities experience that we all think of as disability is, in fact, socially and culturally created. It's created by cultural values about appearance and functioning, what makes a person human, an authentic American. It's created by public policies that can either mandate integration and access or can exclude people with disabilities. I think most Americans are aware of the variety of laws that have been implemented in the last quarter century. What most people may not be aware of is that prior to that time, the laws in this country often deliberately segregated and excluded people with disabilities. The law creates what disability is. The images in the popular culture reflect attitudes and social arrangements. The design of the built environment, just what you've been talking about with Judy about access at your studios, helps to define and make what disability is.
Except I think what I'm asking is, what's going on in the other direction? We've certainly lived through a period where the prevailing kind of experience of disability was shaped by a lot of fears and myths coming from the outside. I guess what I'm wondering is, are disabled people emerging into their own culture that maybe reflects some of this external business, but also reflects a kind of an internal spirit, bringing something unique to the table in and of themselves?
Well, unquestionably, there have been cultures or subcultures of disability for a long time. The deaf community has had its own language and its own institutions. It's constituted a subculture for about a century and a half in this country. There have been other subcultures, I think, involving people with other kinds of disabilities. And what's emerged in the last decade or so is the sense among a growing number of people with disabilities that their experience, individually and collectively, actually gives rise to different ways of looking at things, an alternative set of values that helps to define in a positive way their identities and their modes of functioning. And that, I think this is what you're leading to, that can enable Americans with disabilities to offer a distinctive and very useful alternative way of looking at things for the whole of this society. A cultural critique.
All right. Let me pass that along to Judy Heumann. Do disabled people have their own cuisine, have their own style of doing things? Do they spice their foods specifically differently?
Yes, very hot. We only eat our food very hot. I've had my disability since 1949, and Paul and others like Paul, who are academics and also have disabilities, have, I think, in a very constructive way, over the last 10 years, really been formulating a philosophy around culture and disability. But for those of us who just lived it for many years, the way I would define it is, because of the discrimination that has historically existed within the society, for myself personally, I felt frequently much more comfortable being around disabled people. Not to say that I didn't want to be with non-disabled people, but I was treated differently when I was with disabled people. Many times I would, when being out in the quote-unquote real world or big world with non-disabled people, they would look at me differently and talk to me differently, and I would frequently feel like I'm a Martian. I mean, I remember.
So you've got your own sort of wheelchair homies, I guess.
Well, not even just people in wheelchairs, but people who have different types of disabilities. I think, we're more accepting of each other. We can ask each other questions. We just accept the fact that we have differences.
Is this new?
As I said, for me personally, it may be new that people are speaking out more about it. But from the 50s and 60s, it's something that I know, being with friends, we talked about it a lot. And we began to use it, as Paul was saying, as a way of defining ourselves. And I think in the 60s and 70s, when we saw more progressive disability rights organizations being formulated, where we also insisted on being in charge of our organizations as opposed to the charitable models, which were run by non-disabled people, asking non-disabled people to give money to cure us, the organizations that began to be formulated by disabled people were much more proactive civil rights organizations.
And Centers for Independent Living, that sort of thing. Of course, Yes. We want to hear all of your stories or any of your stories or any of your questions about any of this. If you have a notion of disability culture, or if you think your particular experience is relevant, or if you know of someone who has affected you in a particular way, you can call us, as you can always call Talk of the Nation, by dialing 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. John Callahan in Portland, Oregon. Do you think there are disability generations?
Yes, I think that disabled people are so much more visual now that the older disability. I mean, I come from 20 years ago being paralyzed, and you couldn't even. People really were kept back in the back rooms and stuff. I mean, really, I was the only one ever to be seen in an alcoholic treatment meeting or something at the time. And I remember living in L.A., I had to go from driveway to driveway. I had to drive side down the street and go up the driveways to get up on the sidewalks and to travel because they had no curb cuts way back then. And socially and stuff, it's much more acceptable. People aren't surprised or don't avert their eyes now anymore with disabled people. I mean,
You're a car accident guy, right?
Car accident. People, right. Things
and
have
Judy and Paul are...
We're the better side. We had the virus.
Judy and Paul are your polio guys, right?
The best.
Yeah.
The best, right.
The old guard.
Right.
So two car accident guys and two polio folks. So that's old and new generation.
That's since the old Jim Quad laws of the 50s.
The Jim Quad laws, yes. Right. Right. Yeah. Abraham Lincoln. I guess that would be, who would that be? What would the
emancipation?
FDR?
Chris Reeves.
Chris Reeves trying to do the Emancipation Proclamation, right?
Chris Reeves is putting a lot of pressure on us now because we have to be kind of super quads. He's got so much courage and drive and energy and stuff. It makes me look kind of bad. I've got to clean up my image. I'm kind of known as the anti-quad, I'm afraid.
And because your particular
humor...
Well, no,
just because of my cartoons. Really, I'm not.
Right.
It's just that I've got to kind of clean up my act and get out there and do some good for the world. Chris Reeves is putting a certain amount of pressure.
Really John... Do you think it would have been possible for you to publish successfully your cartoon strip, say, 20 years ago?
I don't know. Not as much, no. I mean, I usually, when I first started publishing, was with Penthouse, and they were surprised after a couple of years of publishing me, and they called me up one day and said, why did you tell us you're in a wheelchair? I see you've done this, all these cartoons about wheelchairs. We didn't know. I said, why was it important? It really wasn't important. I tried really hard to be published without having that be known to people.
You know, I was in the 30 Rockefeller Center, which is where I work now at NBC News, and Rosie O'Donnell's show is produced there. And before she went on the air about a year and a half ago or something like that, I was rolling through the lobby of 30 Rockefeller Center, and I see Rosie O'Donnell across the lobby, and suddenly she starts screaming, hey, you, yeah, you're that funny guy, that cartoonist, yeah, yeah, and she starts running after me. And I realized that she thought I was you, and it was one of these, like, all people in wheelchairs look alike kind of thing. I just ran away, hysterically. I was terrified.
Yeah, I always deny the same thing when somebody does that to me.
You get confused for me a lot?
Yeah, well, no, sure. No. Oh, I pretend that I am you, though.
I get confused for Judy. All the time.
And I
people
for
are
you.
Always, yes, right. All right, let's take some calls. Paul, Judy, and John, sit tight. We're going to go first to Ocean County, New Jersey. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Just fine.
I think that in a lot of cases, it seems to me that maybe, let's go back about 10 years, when folks were using wheelchairs and when they were, obviously there was a physical handicap, I think that society in general... And me personally we acknowledged that there was a problem because it is a problem. It's a problem when you're rushing in a wheelchair through a crowd and nobody gets out of your way, or there's too many people and you can't see where you're going. And I understand this because I have friends that have handicaps. But I was in a restaurant the other day.
But are they your best friends?
Sorry?
But are they your best friends?
Are they my best friends? Yeah. I don't use that term.
No. I'm sorry. I'm just
no, I think that's that
a
alienates,
very,
alienates,
it's a very cheap shot. That's a very cheap shot. Continue your story.
Well, we'll talk about that later. I was in a restaurant the other day, and what ended up happening is a young child was using a walker, and there were about 15 or 20 people in the restaurant, and on his way out, his father had walked out the door before him. On his way out, he got stuck on a rug that ended up coming up, and he couldn't move. Nobody knew what to do. Not one person in that restaurant, and everybody in the restaurant had their eyes just fixed on this child.
Now, are you saying that the reason that people are maybe uncomfortable in a situation like that is
I don't think it has anything to do with being uncomfortable. I think that we've gone from one extreme all the way over to another.
People are scared to act.
Where we barely acknowledge people anymore. And this has only been my experience, and I can only, of course, speak for myself. But I don't think that we give people with disabilities enough. I think that we've gone so far over to the right side of things that we don't even see them anymore. And we feel, and I know that this is the attitude of a lot of people that I've run across, we feel that, well, hey, they want to live lives like the rest of us live, which is patently impossible.
What do you mean
Let's
it's patently
impossible?
Just let
them do whatever they want to do, and I'm not going to help anybody anymore. And I'm not. It's you know what? It has to do a lot to do with society. It has a lot to do with the fact that we're just callous.
Bill, wait a minute. What do you mean people with disabilities can't live the same kinds of lives?
It's quite obvious. You can't jump in a car and just take off and do whatever you want to do when you're in a wheelchair.
That's what I did this morning. Well, I jumped in a car and
yes,
drove here.
You must admit, and you have, and let's. I'd like to be honest. You must admit that there are certain problems that come into play. You just spoke at the beginning of the show about inaccessible buildings.
Okay, but can you, Bill, right, fine. There are physical issues, sure. Can you pole vault, Bill?
Can I pole vault?
Yeah.
You know, it's really funny that you mentioned that. I used to pole vault in high school.
But you can't anymore. You can't anymore, can you?
I may or may not. I probably
You may or may not. You choose not to because it's hard, right? It's like a big pain in the butt, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I know it's difficult.
Can you scuba dive, Bill?
I've never scuba dived.
All right, so you have a disability where you can't scuba dive.
I disagree. I think
you're out of luck.
I think that you're going to an extreme when you say that. If I choose.
All right, let's hear what Paul and Judy have to say.
If I chose to scuba dive, I could.
Well, I think Bill is assuming. Bill, you're assuming that if a person with a disability, a wheelchair rider, or someone else, has trouble getting into an inaccessible building, it's because of their disability rather than because of the building. The building didn't have to be designed that way. Make the building accessible. There's no difference. People can function in the same environment.
But let's take his point to some extent. Do you think some of the changes in daily life and social policy regarding the disabled has made people more uncomfortable about, hey, do you need help?
I think we're in an era of transition. The old rules don't apply anymore. They were at least guidelines for behavior. They told us how to relate to one another. Now everything's up for grabs. Things are in transition. Nobody knows how to act, including people with disabilities. What do we expect of one another? How are we supposed to relate? I think that it's in flux. It's changing. It's got to be redefined. There's going to be a time of discomfort till we figure out what the new rules ought to be that render dignity to everybody.
Do you agree with that, Judy?
I think in the case of the child that Bill was talking about, I think people still are uncomfortable sometimes about interacting with disabled people, and especially if they were afraid that he maybe was going to hurt himself. And so, oh my goodness, what should they do? I do think, as Paul was saying, that we really are in a changing period of time where there's a lot more exposure of disabled people into the general society. And I think the message that we're giving is not the one that people grew up with. It's no longer give us your dime so you can cure us. It's give us our rights so that we can be integrated into the community.
I mean, is that a good thing? I mean, it's possible that today, if Helen Keller was alive, you know, she'd be like found dead on the subway or something. Everyone would have ignored her. You know, she'd walk up to somebody and start to, you know, put her fingers on their mouth. And
God, I think it'd be great if Helen,
beat her up.
If Helen Keller was alive today, I think we'd be very lucky. Great socialist in our midst.
Yes, very rare. Yeah, right. That's rarer than her particular disability. All right, let's take another call. We're going to go to Thomas in San Francisco, California. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi, John. First, I'd like to say that it's really great to hear you back on the air again. I was disappointed when you left in 92.
Thanks. I do have this other job on NBC television. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I've seen you from time to time.
Some people can get it. Yeah, okay, great. Go ahead. What's up?
My question is, I was wondering if you have experienced any sort of backlash against having to provide access to public buildings and to workplaces, similar to, here in California, immigrants have experienced a backlash against them and providing them with rights.
I think
that's very interesting. Judy, why don't you take that? You're sort of right on the cusp of that whole issue.
Well, you know, I think there is certainly a tension which exists as we push forward in really becoming equal within the society. And one of the areas that I have responsibility for is the education of disabled children around the United States. And as we really are moving to enforce this law, which basically requires that the vast majority of disabled children be in regular classrooms with appropriate aids and supports, there are some who are really recognizing the value of this, both for themselves as teachers and for the benefit of the class overall. And there are others who would still like things to be the old way, where special education was seen as a place and not a service, and special ed children were the special ed teachers' responsibilities and not the regular ed teachers' responsibilities. But I think that is really beginning to change as it's becoming clear that people are really benefiting from these changes. I don't think it's going to change overnight, but I do think that what's happened is that parents and disabled people ourselves are not going to go back to the old way of living.
John Callahan, do you see a backlash?
Yeah, people are tough on me nowadays. I take the brunt of a lot of this, just really strong ADA movement where everybody's living in fear of everything being, you know, accessible to the disabled out here in Portland. I've had a lot of people complain to me that it's just too strident, too tough. And
do you think the ADA is too tough?
No, not at all. I think everything should be accessible. I went down the street the other day and I saw a hooker that had a handicapped, you know, access sign on her.
So, really?
I see. Everything is becoming
great,
and it's good.
Great. When you were on 60 Minutes a couple of years ago, Mr. Callahan, how did that affect your life?
Well, it was the feeling. I mean, one day you're totally obscure, and the next day you can't go anywhere in the country without people coming up and saying, "Aren't you that guy that was on TV last night?" It's just a strange feeling, and you know, it's good. It takes some getting used to.
Do you think Mike Wallace asked appropriate questions
well,
in that program?
Yeah, I
or
thought
whoever
it was.
Really,
it was Morley Safer.
It was
I thought they were going to really hang me. They buttered me up pretty good, and then when they started, they got pretty tough with me. But, you know, I thought it would, I was afraid it would be Mike Wallace, and I was afraid he'd really give me the real tough, you know, the alleged handicapped person, John Callahan.
Yeah, right. Right, well, you're in a wheelchair, so they, like, were really soft on you, you know. That's typical, typical. All right, let's take another call from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Siggy, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, John. This is Siggy from Philadelphia.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks. And hi to Judy and Paul Longmore.
Hi, dear.
I'm calling to reminisce with Judy that back in 1976, aside from our 504 demonstrations in 76 and 77,
explain what that is, would you, Siggy?
504 sure. Back in 1976, 77, we had a law on the books requiring an end to discrimination and the elimination of architectural barriers in anything that received federal funding. The problem was the regulations which would implement and enforce that law were not being issued. So the disability community organized in the 10 federal regions around the country. There was a major sit-in in California, which Judy led along with others, and for 27 days, I think it's still the longest sit-in that it was ever held in a federal building. And then we all went down to Washington and demonstrated at the White House in various federal venues to secure those regulations, which Secretary Califano, Secretary of then HEW, issued in April.
Fine. So a point you want to make, not that there's not a point in relating that, but I'm just getting up near a break. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, the question I have is regarding how people with disabilities are portrayed in the media. Judy was a guest on what I believe was the first radio program on disability issues that I hosted back in 1976 through 79, and I'd like them to talk about whether any significant change has been brought about and how we're portrayed in film and television in particular.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judy, you want to take that?
Well, I think it's fair to say that over the course of my lifespan, we have begun to see a change in the way disabled people are depicted. We're not where we need to be yet, I think, at all, but certainly we are seeing disabled people in productions. We're seeing disabled kids and adults in advertisements in just more everyday type of living. But we still have, and I think Paul can really get into talking about this a lot more, we still have much of the old baggage stories that people still look at. And I think the society overall still has not grasped that disability is a normal part of life and that our goal really is not, well, my goal is not to become non-disabled. My goal is not to walk again. My goal is to be able to make society accessible to me and accept me for who I am.
So I don't believe that. Come on, you want to walk, Judy? Come on.
I'm going to walk from here to New York. Time.
You want a cure? Come on. Come on. Paul, you too, right?
I already walk.
Yeah, right.
He's
this
an upside-down polio.
This is radio. See, we're all dancing.
Stigmatized even by my own group.
Right.
But with regard to the media images.
But hold on one second. Back off from that, because I think what Judy was saying is interesting. She wants to be known as someone who's not looking for a cure. When you say that, do people say to you, Paul, John, Judy, well, of course you would have to think that because otherwise you just couldn't cope with what's going on, that you actually don't believe that, you're just sort of coping?
I think people believe that. I think it's definitely true that people think, oh, if the cure was there and you gave it to her, would she really not take it? But I think it's difficult for people to understand, you know, if you said to a woman, well, it's easier to be a man in our society, so do you want to be able to be a man? They would say, in most cases, what are you, crazy? I like who I am. And to me, it's the same thing. Disability is a part of my life. It's very true that, you know, women want the barriers that have prevented us from being equals in society to be removed, just like as a disabled woman, I want the barriers, the physical barriers and attitudinal barriers that have prevented me from being equal within the society to be removed also. But it doesn't mean that my goal is to be a non-disabled person.
Would you agree with that, John?
Yeah, it's the same thing with me. I agree completely, yeah.
We're joined now by Robert Watson, the executive director of Date Able, a social service for people with disabilities. Welcome, Robert.
Hello, John.
How you doing?
Great, great, great.
So now, Date Able, is that wheelchair dial-a-date?
Basically, it's a wheelchair, non-wheelchair, canes, crutches, hidden disabilities, you name it. We have them.
Now, how does it work exactly?
Basically, we have two types of organizations. We have the local one in Washington, which people join. They come in and do a separate interview, and we have a lot of social events. And then we have the Date Able International that people can join on the internet and through the mail, and they get matched up once a month.
So you're actually sending people out on dates that may hopefully become relationships, right?
Oh, yes, sir, and a lot of them have become marriages.
A lot of them become marriages.
Live-ins, marriages, you name it. Yes,
now,
sir.
Let me see. Most listeners may think of the personal ads as the closest analog to what you do. And I'm wondering, first of all, if based on disability, people want to be paired with the same disability. Like if their right arm's amputated, like please only link me up with people whose right arm is amputated or something like that. Or if it's much more of a mix.
Oh, it's a pure mix. If anything, it's the direct opposite. If I had cerebral palsy, I don't want to be matched up with a cerebral palsy person. We find that we match on personality and likes and dislikes. And that's what works, not disability.
Would it have even been possible for you to start this organization 20, 25 years ago?
Oh, no, sir.
Because?
Oh, we were taught that we were not sexual. We were not supposed to date. We weren't supposed to have a family. Now, that's 20, 25 years ago.
So wait a minute, Robert. It's okay to be sexual and have a disability?
Oh, not 25 years ago. Now it is. We're making it okay.
Now, without getting into too many details, how do you meet somebody? What do you talk about on the first date?
Well, I was a member of Date Able before I became the director, and I know with my first match, we just talked about general stuff. The Redskins, what we like, what we dislike.
The Washington Redskins, because you're down there in D.C.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Washington Redskins. And basically, it was no
different. I hate the Redskins, Robert, by the way.
Boy, John, I tell you, I thought you didn't have a flaw. No, but basically, you know, it's no different than talking to any other date.
Let me ask you another. I'm thinking of all kinds of prurient things to ask, and I think that's a sign of our empowerment as disabled people. But let me ask you, do people who are already married who have disabilities come to Date Able looking for like a discreet kind of on-the-side relationship?
We've had a few.
You've had a few?
Yes, sir.
What does that say?
What does it say?
Yeah.
It says that we're human. You know, just because you're disabled doesn't take you out of the the adultery picture, and you know everybody's people. You take the disability away, we're people, and that's what we reflect as people, not just disabled people.
Can I ask you one Howard Stern question, Robert?
Go right ahead.
Okay, so which disability is better at sex?
Oh, cerebral palsy, because you have that jerky motion. It's a fact. We've had surveys. Cerebral palsy is great.
Yeah. You might be just a little bit biased, Robert, huh?
Well, I'm biased. I've heard that paraplegics are good too because of the shot. But you know, I wouldn't.
Because of
that.
The shots, you mean
the prolonged erection, right? Shot? Yes, sir.
You know, it's amazing how much of this is totally unknown to people. I mean, we might as well be in Siberia talking about these details.
I agree.
I want to tell you, Robert, that the National Public Radio Bureau here in New York City is located on 2nd Avenue right next to Pfizer World Headquarters, which, of course, is the maker of Viagra.
Yes, sir.
So we're well located. I mean, we call it the Viagra building here in New York.
Well,
Robert, I want to tell you it's been great talking to you. DateAble is an organization that operates out of Washington, D.C., but you work nationally, correct?
Yes, sir, and we're also for people with and without disabilities. That's important. We have 10% of our population doesn't have disabilities, so that's always important to know.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us, and I'll see you next time I'm down in D.C.
Thank you, John.
Robert Watson is the executive director of DateAble. He joined us by phone from Chevy Chase, Maryland. Of course, you can call us. Our number in Washington is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. This is Talk of the Nation. My guests for the remainder of the hour are Paul Longmore, director of the Institute on Disabilities and a professor of history at San Francisco State University. Judy Newman is assistant secretary for Special Education and Rehabilitation Services. And John Callahan, cartoonist. His strip is called No Witnesses. And he's the author of Will the Real John Callahan Please Stand Up? I'm going to take a call right now from Okemos, Michigan. Critter, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello there. Can you hear me all right?
I certainly can.
Okay. You're a little soft there at that end, but that's okay.
I'll speak up.
I want to first off say thank you, John. I know you've been involved in the disability rights movement in a variety of ways that have touched on the lives of everyday people, and for instance, and the things you do, like the program you did last fall on NBC that had to do with the sting operation, for lack of a better term.
Oh, you did. Let me just tell people what you're talking about there. I did a story for Dateline where we took a hidden camera in to show people in employment and in housing being discriminated against with physical disabilities. So anyway, go ahead. What's your question?
Well, actually, the program is going much better than I anticipated it would, and I think perhaps it's because you're the guest. I don't want to stroke you too much, but you're doing a great job. On the other hand, I am David, and the disability industry is Goliath. I'm one of those people that's always pushing the envelope, and one of my pet peeves has to do with people like your guests today who are very positive and so forth. On the other hand, they don't speak for me, and there are lots of people. Why not? Because I have my own life experience, which is different than Judy's or John's, just as FDR had a different experience than in Germany in state hospitals that were used as guinea pigs to develop the gas chamber. We all have our own kinds of life experiences.
Fine, Critter. Let me just try to characterize what I think you're saying a little bit, and you can tell me if I'm wrong. Are you uncomfortable with this kind of militant advocate style?
No, but I am uncomfortable that the lucky and the strong get into positions such as Judy is in, and that doesn't trickle down to the average guy in the street. And I have 46 years of credentials, so I hope they won't waste time sort of trying to
convince
them. All right,
well, Critter, I hope
that
things...
I'm confused. But in any event, the disability industry, in some cases that are charity organizations like Goodwill, in some cases it's organizations like the President's Commission on Employment, they spend millions and millions of dollars that if it went to you or I, the person that needs, just because it's most obvious perhaps, a wheelchair, for people on Medicaid, Medicare, they have to go through a dozen people approving what they need. Now, the average guy.
All right, let's get a comment. Critter, let's get
permission from the government to buy those shoes. But if you need a wheelchair, you need to get an okay from this agency and that agency, and then they say, well, we've decided.
All right, Critter, let me get a comment from Judy, who's our representative from HHS right now. Go ahead, Judy.
Actually, I'm from the Department of Education, but anyway.
Or Department of, I'm sorry.
No problem. Sorry. I understand much of what Critter is saying, since I think for disabled individuals who are working and don't have health insurance that's adequate or who are in benefits and have to get basic essentials like wheelchairs, the bureaucracy that people sometimes have to go through is not very respectful.
And well, in fact, the industry has been affected by that. I mean, for a long time, the VA contract for wheelchairs was held by one company, Everest and Jennings, and they had a virtual monopoly, and it affected wheelchair design for really almost 25 years.
And I think that's changed over the last 20 years as we've seen more companies like Quickie and others come into the market and actually take over a larger share than what Everest and Jennings had. But I do think that one of the benefits of many of the pieces of legislation that have existed now, like the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, is that these laws are helping people be afforded equality, the ability to get education, the ability to have a right to be able to go into a restaurant, a theater, the right to be able to apply for a job, and if you're discriminated against based on disability, to file a complaint. So
it's less about income transfer or resource transfer and more about actual empowerment
in the legal sense. Well, I think there's still a very big issue because about 65 to 70% of the disabled population are unemployed. And so many individuals are living on benefit programs, which obviously does not enable one to live a good life. Mm-hmm. And one of the main issues that many of us are working on, the president just put out an executive order to work on issues around employment and improving employment for disabled people, are to look at what the barriers are that are preventing us from getting into the world of work and removing those barriers so that, you know, data that we find from like the Lou Harris poll, which says that more than 50% of people who have disabilities want to work, that those individuals can have the opportunity to work.
Okay. In San Francisco, Sandra, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Judy. Hi, John. I know, Judy, you're a representative from the Department of Education, so, and I think, John, you too would understand what I'm talking about when I say invisible handicaps having to do with learning challenges or differences, learning disabilities. I think we need to use a different term other than the negative disability unless you have a different point of view. I'd like you to...
Well, I use disability just because I'm ruined. I mean, it's like the only word I know how to use, and I'm too like old at this point to come up with a different word. I don't want it to offend you, but I'm very interested in this idea of invisible disabilities or invisible handicaps in the sense that I think the movement for disability rights has really been earmarked or sort of spearheaded by people with very visible disabilities. And I think, the symbol for disability access is a wheelchair, and there are plenty of people who aren't in wheelchairs who are disabled.
Right. And when you talk about unemployed, I'm involved with several organizations that deal with the learning challenges and attention deficit disorder. A lot of these people get caught in the catch-22 of not being able to be employed. Yes, they do want to work. Yes, they're very bright. If they only had medical coverage or insurance, you know, to assist them to be able to work, because of the learning problems or the attention problems, they would be able to be employed. But they can't even get medical care, therefore they can't work. You know?
Is that because their disability is a pre-existing condition that makes it more difficult for them to get on the road? Well, Judy or...
I'm sorry, not just because of pre... Because it... there's no place for someone who's not on Medicare or Medicaid, you know, to get help.
I think the point that Sandra is making is a very good one, and, you know, not making light of this anymore. I think we're in the more serious part of the discussion right now. A substantial number of individuals have invisible disabilities, learning disabilities, epilepsy, diabetes, cancer, back problems, etc. And when we look at the population of individuals with learning disabilities, of the 6 million children who've been identified as eligible for the special ed law, a little more than 50% of those have learning disabilities. And some of the challenges, I think, for individuals who have learning disabilities is assuring that they can be identified early and get appropriate interventions early on, like when they're 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. Because we find for many individuals who have learning disabilities, if they're not identified early, they're not going to get services which, for example, will enable them to learn to read. And so illiteracy can be something that can be a very big problem in trying to seek employment. In addition to the fact that what Sandra is saying is that companies don't necessarily provide health insurance, particularly in jobs that are not high-paying jobs. So if an individual has a learning disability, and if they haven't learned how to read effectively, if they're not going to be competitive enough for a job which will give them a high enough wage to be in a job which is more likely to provide them with health insurance, then they're really stuck.
I'm John Hockenberry in for Ray Suarez, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. John Callahan, did you try to apply for a job ever before you became a successful published cartoonist?
No, I really didn't. I just did volunteer work and stuff. I really wasn't interested too much. I was going to college and was trained as an English teacher. But
So you wanted to be unemployed if you were trained as an English teacher, correct? Yeah, that's sort of what you were trained to do.
Yeah.
Did you ever, in my personal case, I never went in for a job interview except for once because I just sort of assumed it wouldn't go well, and I stumbled onto the radio in many ways because I was able to do it over the phone. No one could see me. It was more comfortable that way, and by the time I got hired, you know, I'd already been doing the job, so the questions were all moot as to whether I could do it. Did you have that experience at all?
No, it was just a simple case of, I guess I did have some of that problem. Mainly, people wanted to put me, sort of direct me into being a stand-up comic and going on TV a lot and stuff. I didn't really like the medium that much, so people thought I was good visually, so... my disabilities. I've always made it work for me in the employment in a field. It's always worked really well for me to get me jobs, you know.
Now, is that because you're, like, taking advantage of your disability or
I've always
cheating?
Used it. I mean, in time when I had to go around for cartoon jobs and stuff and talk to editors and newspapers, the buildings would never be accessible in the elevators and stuff, so I would always just have to have a secretary go in the building and drag the boss all the way down the steps to me on the sidewalk, and that would have a tremendous, you know, impact on them.
And by then he would be really softened up by the time he gets down to the front. Yeah. Oh, that's great. I read somewhere that you're running for something politically considering it.
Well, I ran for state representative a couple of years ago. And
how did it go?
My disability got in the way, and I had to go in the hospital with an infection. But I'm glad I didn't run. I'm glad to be out of that arena now, and I've got it out of my system, you know.
From Orono, Maine, caller Mike. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, John. Hi, Judy. Hi, Paul. Hi, Mr. Callahan. This is a great collection of people, and I'm really interested in listening for the last half hour.
Mike, I'm listening to your accent. Excuse me. Do you have cerebral palsy?
Yes, I do.
Would you agree with Robert Watson that people with cerebral palsy have the best sex?
Yeah, we do.
Okay, anyway, what's your question?
He's wrong. It's polio. Sorry.
Boy, a lot of human behavior in this show. Mike, what's your question?
I'm a disability studies major at the University of Maine. I wonder if you know me, John.
You're a disability... you're a disability studies major?
Yeah, I'm doing a concentration in the field, so I'm an English major, so I took offense to the unemployment remark.
Sorry.
I'm wondering...
You'll find out.
No comment. I'm wondering, I'm graduating in a week. Actually, I'm graduating this Saturday. And I'm wondering, where do people like Mrs. Human and Mr. Longmore, and maybe you and Mr. Callahan can pipe in, see the disability studies movement in 20 years?
Okay, good question. Thank you, Mike. Paul, I'll give that to you.
Well, it's a burgeoning field. There's a growing number of undergraduate and graduate students who are looking at disability through the lenses of their particular disciplines. I'm hoping that over the next generation, there are going to be people emerging in a variety of academic disciplines who are going to, as one of the things they do, specialize in disability studies. I mean, this is not some intellectual fad. It's a serious scholarly analysis of the experience of disability and all things related to it, like public policy.
But is that, I mean, some people might hear disability studies and go, oh, great, another department where people, you know, sit around and find pictures that make them mad, you know, about how they were, like, discriminated against in the past. You talked at the beginning of the hour about how disability is a worldview that maybe critiques society independent of issues of, you know, access. What does disability studies give back to people who aren't disabled?
It offers us a different angle of vision for analyzing a whole array of social and cultural questions. For instance, American notions about individualism and equality and sexuality, you'll be happy to know. All sorts of ideas about what makes a person human, about citizenship, all the whole full range of issues that scholars examine anyway can be looked at in a fresh way through a disability studies perspective.
I think
Judy, I was at an event recently, and I think this question is perfect for you, where a mother stood up who was having difficulty getting her kids into schools, and they were disabled children, and she said, how come people can go through their entire elementary, secondary education and never encounter a disabled person and still be considered educated? Her point being that if you don't encounter disability in your life, you've missed something important in the same way that you would have missed a foreign language.
I completely agree with her. And if and when the law is completely implemented appropriately, that really won't happen. But since a majority of the people will have invisible disabilities, it's going to also be important for people who have those invisible disabilities to speak out.
All right, Callahan, I'll give you the last word. You want to leave us with anything?
If I take Viagra, will my joystick be effective?
That's great. I want to thank everybody for a terrific hour. My guests were Paul Longmore, director of the Institute on Disabilities at San Francisco State University, also professor of history there, Judy Heumann, assistant secretary for special education and rehabilitation services in Washington, D.C., and John Callahan, a cartoonist. His strip is entitled No Witnesses. Author, will the real John Callahan please stand up?